Well, welcome back to segment two of True News for Monday, June 4, 2012. After decades of silence on the annual gathering of the elite called the Bilderberg Group, the elitist Washington Post finally acknowledged in print days ago that the group does exist. Only a few years ago, mentioning Bilderberg was enough to get you assigned to a membership in the Tinfoil Hat Club. Finally, however, the venerable Washington Post actually told its readers this weekend, the Bilderberg Group is real. The headline said, is Bilderberg a conference on world affairs or a powerful global cabal? Depends on who you ask. The Washington Post said a dull office park near Dulles International Airport took on the sheen of a Hollywood thriller this week when an invitation-only cadre of global leaders gathered for a secretive meeting known as the Bilderberg Conference. Henry Kissinger and Bill Gates were chauffeured in. Fairfax County Police established a security perimeter around the Westfield's Marriott and prohibited the Washington Post photographer from snapping pictures from a public street. Outside the Jersey barriers, dozens of protesters and conspiracy theorists convinced that Bilderberg is a global cabal that runs the world waved signs and shouted into bullhorns. One said, honk if you hate the New World Order. According to the website, the Bilderberg meeting was organized by leaders from Western Europe and North America in the early days. I'm reading from the Washington Post. Organized in Western Europe and North America in the early days of the Cold War, named for the Dutch hotel where the first conclave was held in 1954. About 120 people participate in nearly 3 days of informal, off-the-record discussions about topics of current concern in economics and foreign affairs. Attendees are encouraged not to discuss the proceedings, which fuels the secrecy concern. Well, my guest today is an investigative journalist from Great Britain who has tracked the Bilderberg Group for years. And he posts his findings on his website, Bilderberg.org, Bilderberg.org. This is my first time to talk with Mr. Tony Gosling from Great Britain. Tony, welcome to the program.
Well, Rick, thanks very much for inviting me on.
Yes, sir. Is your last name Gosling or Gosling?
Gosling.
Yes. Gosling, okay, all right.
One of the things I'd like to sort of add to the Washington Post report, well, it's a sort of tiptoeing around the issues report, is that the very first meeting they mentioned has got its name from the Bilderberg Hotel, which is in a little town called Oosterbeek near Arnhem in Holland. One of the things we've dug out this year, and I mean, the thing is, this is such a rich seam of gold when it comes to investigative journalism. There's still, I'm sure, a lot more to be dug out on the Bilderbergs. This year, along with an ex-employee of Marconi Electronics, which is an old British, now defunct, military electronics company, we found out that the actual site of the very first Bilderberg meeting back in 1954, exactly 10 years before that first meeting, was the site of a particularly bloody battle during the Second World War. And the significance of it is particularly nasty because this was a site where it looks like, due to a German spy in Whitehall, that is Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who's a former SS officer, former Nazi Party member, who had managed to get his way into the war planning offices in London. Due to the spying, it looks like a load of British, particularly British paratroops, along with some of their American cousins, were dropped into a situation, the biggest, it's Operation Market Garden, the biggest airborne operation in history, where they were actually surrounded by some of the crack troops of the SS German army, and they were surrounded near Arnhem, on a little pocket in this same town, Oosterbeek, when they were there for 5 or 6 days. Basically, they're just infantry with quite light weapons, really, surrounded by tanks, flamethrowers, rockets, mortars, and they were absolutely hammered over those days. There were obviously many British killed. In fact, it was such a hot spot in the Second World War that it was nicknamed at the time by the Germans the Hexenkessel, which is the witch's cauldron. And eventually the British were, the remaining ones were evacuated, but it was exactly this spot, which they won't tell you in the Bilderberg press releases or in the Washington Post, where the very first ever Bilderberg meeting took place. And incredibly enough, the meeting was chaired by this same Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was a former Nazi SS officer earlier in the 1930s, and he was a member of the Nazi Party while he was actually at college at university. So pretty shocking to find that there is this rather nasty Nazi angle to the very beginning, the very first ever meeting of the Bilderbergs.
Tony, do you think there's a secret message in that selection of that site?
Well, it certainly looks as if it's almost in honour of that particular battle. You know, they're calling it, calling the conference after that site. And I think in a way it's a kind of in joke, you could probably call it, amongst the people who are in the know about the modern manifestation of the, well, I suppose what you would call the modern manifestation of the Nazi Party, because certainly the swastikas have all gone. But importantly, the money that was looted from right across Europe during the Second World War, very, very little of it was actually tracked down in 1945, because the Nazis in August 1944 had a meeting in Strasbourg called the Red House Meeting in August, where they set in train something called Operation Safe Haven in the British intelligence and American intelligence parlance at the time, and Operation Action Feuerland, which was the German version of the same operation, where they basically, it was a Nazi flight capital operation to make sure that the loot that they got during World War II was secreted out secretly through Switzerland, using things like submarines to get it across to Argentina, Buenos Aires, places like this. And then Martin Bormann, who was Hitler's deputy most of the way through the Second World War, he actually made it across secretly to South America, and he was busy setting up 750 new corporations in different countries around the world, where once this money had been laundered, it was then invested into these firms, and supporters of the SS were secretly, although of course, they weren't wearing their SS uniforms, they were just wearing suits, you know, they were made directors of these various corporations. And it's pretty clear now through this book, which was published in 1982 by Paul Manning, who is a CBS news correspondent during World War II in Europe, sending stuff across for the Americans to keep track of what was going on in World War II. His book's called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And in that book, he really describes this whole Nazi capital flight operation. And people have questioned me as to whether that's got any relevance to Bilderberg whatsoever, but I can point directly to many references, one of which is the Swedish family, the Wallenbergs, who are mentioned in the book as being the recipients in Sweden of vast amounts of this laundered Nazi money. Now, they are actually, their representative is there, or was there this weekend at this Bilderberg conference. So I think it's pretty clear what we're dealing with is a sort of economic Fourth Reich kind of organisation, which has got similar types of objectives, basically to, you know, ultimately enslave humanity. I mean, there are international financial criminals in there, with a lot of support from big business, who just simply sees war as another kind of business, another way to make money. And that's why it's all so secret, I think, is because they don't really want the press in there seeing who's there, for a start, because there's an official list which is released. Quite often there are people in there that aren't on that official list. They don't want any people taking photographs through the windows, that sort of thing. I mean, I know for a fact that the last meeting that took place in Britain, Tony Blair wasn't on the list, but he was certainly in the meeting because I spoke to the woman that served him his breakfast. So this is a very dodgy, dangerous organisation, I think. It's pretty clear to me that the intentions are, you know, just basically to make money out of war. And they're doing very, very well at that, you know, with their war on terror, which has got all sorts of rather nasty connotations to it, as I imagine you would agree. I mean, why is America, why are Britain invading these foreign countries and tearing up the UN Charter, doing in a way something rather similar to what Hitler's Nazi Germany was doing in the run-up to World War II, which is starting to invade countries apparently with impunity. We're seeing all over the media here in Britain, as I'm sure you are in the United States, various reasons now, supposed reasons anyway, to invade Syria and to attack Syria. Now, this is a sovereign country, and under the UN Charter, anyone that even suggests such a thing, you know, it allegedly may even be committing a crime under international law by inducing people to break international law. So, you know, we're living in rather a worrying world, even though you wouldn't necessarily know that looking at our dumbed-down mainstream media.
Tony, I've maintained for years that the Germans were defeated in World War II, but the Nazis were not defeated. It's very obvious through historical records that the Nazis simply went underground. And as you've mentioned, there were elements inside Western intelligence agencies and very powerful families that assisted the Nazis in moving their wealth and also moving the Nazis into various countries, including the USA and South America. So over my years of broadcasting, I came to the conclusion years ago that what we are witnessing right now, this thing that we call the New World Order, whatever name you want to give to it, it is the Fourth Reich. It is a resurrection of the Nazi Empire. The Bank of International Settlements in Switzerland, which is the mothership of all central banks, that's a Nazi bank. I mean, every time you trace anything, it seems like you always end up going back to the Nazis.
Yeah, that's right. And I'd also say, you know, what they're characterized by is these false flag attacks, which are a real sort of media shock doctrine style attacks where a horrendous incident is beamed across the world by television. And we're made to think, well, literally within the first 24 hours, we're told the entire story from start to finish about what's happened during this attack. The only thing is, I would say, there is a positive side to all this, and something similar to all this was tried on in France in the run-up to the recent presidential elections in order to try and galvanise votes behind Nicolas Sarkozy. And that was the attack in Toulouse, which was basically an attack on a synagogue, and then two people, I believe, killed outside that synagogue. And then that attack went to onto the apartment flat of the so-called killer. Now, what happened in France, this is about a month before the French presidential elections, was it was then discovered that the guy who was supposed to have done this was actually an agent working with the French intelligence services. It was actually one of the French intelligence services that ratted on another intelligence service, saying, well, we know that this guy was one of yours. And so what you saw in public opinion after that attack was quite heartening, really. It was, to begin with, it was a galvanization of support behind Sarkozy and his war on terror-style policies. But then after a couple of days of this other news coming out saying, well, basically, this guy, we're not really sure even if he had anything to do with that killing, even though we were told that he had filmed it, we were given all sorts of so-called evidence that this guy had filmed the attacks, and it definitely was him, that then Sarkozy's support started to plummet as the French press and the French people started to realize that it looked like this was some kind of false flag attack set up by the French intelligence services to implicate Islamic extremists is some sort of real serious danger to the French people, and that there was to be some kind of security crackdown. That went away. And so, I mean, there is some positive side to all this, and that is that these false flag attacks, such as, well, I would attest the September 11th attacks 2001, particularly due to the fact that there was virtually no US Air Force response to those attacks, and also that Building 7 in the World Trade Center came down with not even a plane hitting it, with some small fires, the whole thing collapsed in what looks very much to be a controlled demolition with explosives pre-placed in the buildings. And also with the London bombings, the 7/7 attacks, where still no evidence has been produced from any of the CCTV cameras that any of these bombers, the four guys that disappeared on the same day as the four bombs went off, there's nothing to actually place those guys in those sites where the bombs went off. It does start to look as if the public is starting to wake up, and more importantly, in a way, the press is starting to wake up and showing a little bit of courage in questioning, as it is there, it is supposed to do. You know, we think of the press in the West as questioning authority. Actually, it doesn't as much as it should do. And in a way, we've got a press which, certainly in the past, has been rather like a kind of Stalinist press, which means that they just simply take the official line they're given by the police and just roll that out to the public. And that forms the first impressions that people get. And then, of course, when things are proven not to be as they seemed first, then they trickle out one by one in small little news stories over a period of several years afterwards. So it's very difficult for people to pin together exactly what happened. But I would say that there is some positive side to all of this, and that is that the press and the public are waking up a little to these kinds of attacks. And also, it seems pretty clear to me that Muslims now are being treated pretty much exactly as the Jews were, scapegoated in the 1930s.
Tony, let's get back to Bilderberg and this conference. What do you know about what happened this past weekend here in the USA? Do you have any sources that are telling you who was there, what was discussed?
Well, certainly, you know, your listeners can go online and find out who was there, at least for the official list. As I said before, Blair was at the 1998 meeting, even though he wasn't on the official list. So it is, in a way, it's only a partial list. The people who were there this year are not totally dissimilar to previous years. The basic makeup of a Bilderberg conference, I think, is probably fair to start with the big funders, that is to say, the people like David Rockefeller, the Council on Foreign Relations. These are the Royal Institute for International Affairs as well. They send people there. These are really effectively foreign policy think tanks, which are funded privately. So they are kind of private clubs, really, but the trouble is that they have a very immense amount of influence and a lot of money to, for example, pay for students to go through university and this kind of thing. They also produce their own magazines and periodicals, have very high-profile websites. The Council on Foreign Relations, the Royal Institute for International Affairs in Britain, and the CFR in the States are really basically the same kind of thing. They are a privatization of foreign policy. So what they do is they roll out what private business thinks that our foreign policy should be. The trouble is their budgets and their political clout are far, far greater than the official things like the State Department and the Foreign Office. So what you end up is that if people are in the Foreign Office here in Britain, start to speak out against this kind of war on terror policy and tearing up the UN Charter, if they say that that's a bad idea, they find they're not in their job for very long. And I would just cite one example of that. It's the British ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, who several years ago started speaking out about torture and the use of torture. He was passing back diplomatic intercepts and also reports from Uzbekistan back to London, which included information which had been gathered under torture. And he complained to the Foreign Office, and then they started trying to get rid of him anyway. Before they actually managed to get rid of him, he resigned. But as you can see, there is no real integrity in the diplomatic service anymore when you've got things like that going on. So the Council on Foreign Relations and Royal Institute for International Affairs are really a privatised version of what our elected people should do. And this is the big problem right across the Western world, is we've got these kind of, almost like ivy strangling the tree, we've got these kind of parallel structures which are built by big business really just to simply push the interests of private business. And our old-fashioned government, that is to say our democratic representatives, hardly get a look in. They'll find bullying campaigns in the Murdoch press and in other press against them if people speak out against this idea that big money should really be ruling the roost in the Western world. So that's essentially what's going on in these Bilderberg conferences. I can tell you that I haven't got any specific leaks from individuals that were in there, like, for example, bartenders and that kind of thing. But I can be absolutely clear, crystal clear with you, and because from past experience, to say that they will be trying to really dominate the Western media, and also they will be doing everything they can to push for high-tech solutions like nuclear power, nuclear energy, which is one of the things the Bilderbergs love, and also to make more and more excuses for foreign intervention in countries that do not come under the Bilderberg sphere of influence. One of the, for example, of the attendees at this particular conference is one of the people from the exiled Syria opposition. So there won't be anybody from the government of Syria in the Bilderberg conference, but there is somebody who NATO would like to be the government. The same exact thing with Russia. So essentially it's a NATO countries conference. In the past, it's always been NATO countries that have been invited. If it's outside the NATO zone, you won't find people there from outside the NATO zone at all. And as new countries like Poland, for example, have acceded to NATO, then you'll find somebody suddenly pops up from Poland at the Bilderberg Conference too, maybe just one representative. And the Russians that are there have either been from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, which is basically an American front organisation in Moscow, or else there'll be the Syrian opposition. So they will have people who are sympathetic to their views. They will not have anybody in that room who is not sympathetic to the idea of a sort of total domination by Western capital and Western financial criminals of the entire world. They've even got some Chinese in there this year, and that we had them turn up for the first time last year. They're more mainstream Chinese. But then, of course, the Bilderberg do have some sort of common cause with China, in that China is a pretty much totalitarian state. They don't accept free speech, they don't accept freedom of expression in China, and the Bilderbergs don't like the idea of freedom of expression in the Western world either. So there is a certain amount of common cause. The other thing is that they've recently, I don't know if you've come across this, but about 2 months ago, the Chinese announced that they were setting in train a program to privatize their state banks. Now, that is an absolutely incredible piece of news, which hasn't really hit home, I don't think, as well as it should have done in the West. Because if you have a look of what's happened to our private banking system in Europe and in North America, I would have thought that most common-sense Chinese people would realise that they would have to retain state control over their banking system. Otherwise, it would go into this sort of runaway disaster situation like we've got here in the West. So very interesting to see these Chinese going along. And it may be that what's happening is the Bilderberg and the West are trying to outflank the Russians, really, to get into policy influence within the Politburo in China in an attempt to isolate the Russians and isolate them, as well as the Iranians and the Syrians too.
Tony, 4 years ago, Bilderberg met in Northern Virginia, which just happened to be the 2008 presidential campaign. Then, by coincidence, 4 years later, during the 2012 presidential campaign, Bilderberg meets again in Northern Virginia. I don't have a complete list of every time they've been in the United States, but for me, I think this is unusual that they would return to the same site, the same general vicinity, twice, and it happens to be during a presidential campaign. We know in 2008, when Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were locked in a very fierce battle for the Democratic presidential nomination, that both Senator Obama and Hillary Clinton suddenly suspended their campaigning. They both flew to Dulles International Airport. The reporters were not allowed to accompany either candidate for a day or so. The candidates disappeared, and then when they reappeared a few days later, Hillary Clinton withdrew from the race, and Barack Obama won the nomination. I think you know where I'm going with this. Most people think that Mr. Obama and Mrs. Clinton were summoned to appear before Bilderberg. What do you know about that series of events in 2008?
Well, it seems pretty clear that the Bilderberg made that decision, not the Democratic Party. What happens is, if you go back through the meetings, which are available on my Bilderberg.org website, but also on places like Wikipedia and various other websites, the locations of the previous annual meetings of the Bilderbergs, is you'll see that quite often they do meet in the United States in the year in the run-up to a presidential election. So there's nothing particularly strange about that. And, of course, it does also indicate that Bilderberg really don't like the idea of the American people electing their own president. They want to be in on the game in the run-up to who actually gets the nomination, whether it's Republican or Democrat. And they want to make sure that their trump cards are all played in the run-up to that election. Of course, looking at all of the candidates nowadays in the presidential election, pretty much you'll find that all of the big money ones are all basically working for these international financial criminals. It's very, very difficult to make a choice. You're caught between a rock and a hard place when you're trying to actually vote for somebody who's going to be good for the people and the, you know, it's better the devil you know sometimes that somebody who's, you know, who seems to be a little bit better. I think, you know, basically Obama has been a reasonably good president considering the alternative was, McCain. But then again, you know, he's hidden a lot of stuff that he's done. I mean, these approval of these international war crimes, the drone strikes, that's been done quite quietly. Obviously, he's not going to, you know, be admitting on mainstream TV, national TV, "Hi guys, I'm a war criminal. I'm signing an executive order here to break international law and the international charter and allow people to do murder from the air anywhere on the surface of the planet." So, you know, that kind of thing does go on. But ultimately, I think you'll find that the Bilderberg this year may be doing things like selecting running mates for the main Republican candidate, or possibly intervening in the Democratic Party too. But they do like to pick the big front runners before they turn up on the scene for the media.
They do have a problem, Tony. I mean, the man that they picked in 2008, Barack Obama, is seriously... he's damaged goods. He's going into this election. Nobody in this country, no intelligent person thinks Barack Obama can legitimately win re-election. I mean, the country is vehemently anti-Obama. There's no way the man could win a legitimate election. So they have a problem. They've got to either somehow rescue their boy and get him through another election, by illegal means or whatever their methods they're going to use, or they're going to have to switch horses in this race and throw their lot in with Mitt Romney. There's something I heard many months ago. This would have been late.
Hey, sorry, can I just interrupt?
Yes, sir, go ahead.
They would be even switching horses because all the main horses in the race are Bilderberg horses.
Of course, yes, I know that, but I'm just saying, you know, the horse that they decide to allow to win. I mean, they put all the horses in the race, and then they decide which horse can win.
I think they'll go with Romney. I think it's quite possible they may put there. But anyway, I mean, it doesn't really matter to them if they've got both horses, both the main horses in the race are their horse. And Romney, right, of course, is a Mormon. Though I've got nothing particularly against the Mormon Church itself, it is based on a very peculiar version of Christianity with this guy Joseph Smith, who apparently found some gold plates with hieroglyphics. He was being channeled back in the mid-1800s. Some kind of angel Moroni told him to go and find some plates with hieroglyphics on, and he was doing automatic writing to write down the Book of Mormon. I'm afraid this is, you know, some sort of travesty of Christianity as far as I'm concerned, although I've got nothing against individual Mormons. We have a serious problem because the whole thing is controlled by, I think, isn't it 12 or 13 specific individuals who believe that they're some kind of chosen ones in Salt Lake City. You know, we have a big, you know, quite a lot of Mormons here in Britain, but I think this is not, these kind of, what I would call a cult, is not really the best thing to be saying, well, that this is going to be a great Christian president, because this is a tainted version of the gospel with a peculiar book.
Yes, well, where I was going with what I was saying was that sometime late last year, my wife and I forget where we were at, we were traveling, and we were in a hotel room, and Oprah Winfrey's channel was on, which I don't watch Oprah Winfrey, but she was interviewing Governor Christie of New Jersey, who seems to be a darling of many of the establishment Republicans here in the United States. And so I was working on my website, getting it ready for the next day, and listening to this interview with Governor Christie. And Oprah Winfrey asked him, tell me about the pressure you were under to enter the Republican race for president. And he began to describe, you know, the tremendous pressure he was under, the phone calls, the visits. And she said, give us an example. What kind of pressure? And he blurted this out. He said, well, Henry Kissinger came to see me. And you know, probably Henry, you know, fell out of his wheelchair if he heard that on TV. You know, it's like, you idiot, you're not supposed to say this on TV. But what it told me, Tony, was that And I'm not a Romney supporter here, so don't misunderstand what I'm saying. What it told me, and this was again late last year, as the campaign was really, you know, they hadn't even had the first primaries yet. But what it told me was, for some reason, the elitists were not completely satisfied or sold on Mitt Romney. They were still shopping. They were still looking for somebody. Because why else would Henry Kissinger be making house calls to Governor Christie late in 2011 trying to persuade him to enter the race? There was something going on there.
Yeah, and I think many people will see that Kissinger himself says, is that, he's basically just retired now, and he's not. He is very, very active in international politics. A lot of people see Kissinger's operations company, Kissinger Associates, as basically like a kind of massive international protection racket. So what happens is, say you're a little president of some little African country in Malawi or Congo or somewhere like that, you'll find there's all sorts of problems on your borders. You know, the villagers are getting killed by mercenaries, and no one's really sure who these mercenaries are working for. And what do? Well, you pick up the phone to the United Nations, and you say, hey guys, you know, can we get some peacekeeping troops down here? And they say, oh, sorry, we haven't got any money, we can't do that. And then what you do is you get your credit card out, you know, and you call up Mr. Kissinger. You get your $1 million minimum out, which apparently is what it costs to speak to him, and you have a chat with Kissinger on the phone, and suddenly the problems in your villages with these mercenaries and these massacres go away for a little while. But then you have to do a deal with Kissinger. So that's essentially what I think we're dealing with here, is a sort of freelance protection racket guy. And ultimately, you know, he is a very important figure at the Bilderberg conferences. A lot of people try and play him down, say, well, you know, he was involved in that fomenting the horrendous coup in Chile in the early 1970s, where tens of thousands of people were disappeared, murdered, tortured as a result. And, you know, he's too embarrassed to strut around on the international scene anymore. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think the opposite is the case.
Mm-hmm. What about David Rockefeller? Is he still active in Bilderberg?
He most definitely is. I mean, in a way, I'd see the pair of those as key figures, really. Kissinger is a sort of international mercenary, private military company operator, in touch with people like XE, whatever they are, used to be called Blackwater, people like that, who are implicated in a lot of the trouble that's been going on in Somalia. I mean, this is really a way of just sort of pushing away responsibility from national governments, is what they do now, is they get freelancers like Kissinger to employ private military companies to do the job, because mm-hmm. it's all then very much deniable. They can say, well, it was nothing to do with us. And so essentially I think that's what's going on. But David Rockefeller is very, very active, yeah. You know,
what is he, 96 years old now?
He's
in his 90s.
He's in his 90s, certainly. But he's just gotten together with Jacob Rothschild.
That was my next question. What do you think about the Rockefeller-Rothschilds merger?
Absolutely astounding. I mean, this is really the two biggest financial power blocks in the Western world, the Eastern Atlantic and the Western Atlantic power blocks. Because, of course, the Rothschilds represent most of the most financially powerful countries in Europe.
Why are they publicly merging? What's going on? What do you think?
Well, certainly I don't think that they would wish it to be necessarily public. This is something which a bit of investigative journalism by the Financial Times seems to have dug out, this merger.
But the Financial Times is owned by the Rothschilds.
Yes, but they can't necessarily stop everything that's going out, you see. This is one of the things, is that owners of newspapers don't necessarily have their fingers on the keys for every single story, and they don't have total control about what journalists write about. I mean, you know, the most important significant thing here, though, is that they are quite clearly getting together to pool their knowledge about what's really going on in the world, to cash in on this kind of distressed capital market we're in at the moment. Because of the financial crash, there are thousands and thousands of businesses out there that simply cannot survive. They don't have the liquidity, they don't have the cash flow, and so they are, the value, as it's being sold, you know, if it was on the market value of those businesses, is going down at quite a rate. So that's what this is all about. This is about massive, big money acquiring real assets, tangible assets. This is money that's been acquired through all sorts of criminal activity, like the various kind of gambling and the derivatives markets and and Enron Accounting.
What was old J.D. Rockefeller, the patriarch of the Rockefeller dynasty? I mean, his motto was buy when there's blood in the streets. And I don't think he was joking. I think he literally meant it. When there's blood in the streets, when there's revolution, that's when you buy. I think what you're saying here, Tony, is that the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds are getting ready to buy companies and assets and real estate pennies on the dollar because there will be blood in the streets.
Quite possibly, yeah. And it certainly is, it gets rid of this whole illusion that the U.S., big U.S. financial elites and the big European financial elites are in any way separate. They aren't. I mean, in fact, with this merger, they are actually now formally one. We are sold in Europe constantly the idea that, oh, well, if you join the Eurozone and the European Central Bank and the EU, then we can be a big trading bloc. It's sort of almost like a United States of Europe to trade, although they don't like using that flat phrase, to compete with the U.S. To sort of take over world markets. Well, you know, it's absolute nonsense because the big firms that are dictating policy in the EU and in the US are basically the same companies. You know, they're really big oil firms and the big financial institutions. These seem to be the ones that are really dictating policy. The international financial criminals. And again, they are funding the Council on Foreign Relations, which is this kind of private version of the U.S. foreign policy, which is far more powerful than the State Department. And they're also funding Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House in London, which is the privatized private club version of our Foreign Office. So, you know, it's sort of a big, it's gone around in one big circle.
Yes.
But the illusion that there is some kind of separate EU power block and a separate US power block with the merger of these two massive financial investment firms really is that a lie has been blown out of the water now.
But Tony, I've got about 4 minutes. My last question I wanted to ask you, is there an occult aspect to Bilderberg?
Well, certainly Freemasonry, yes. I mean, obviously, you know, as I said right at the very start, to do with the Nazi flight capital, the Nazis were very much an occult organization. If you read Peter Levender's excellent books on that, he's done all the research to dig out the origins of the Nazi Party and the SS in the Theosophical Societies and the Thule Society in Germany. And certainly there are links to Freemasonry. The very first ever meeting of the Bilderbergs was organized by Joseph Rettinger, who was himself a Polish Freemason, and he also was working for MI6. But the most important, absolute, definite link to Freemasonry is it comes from my homeland here in the United Kingdom, which is the last Bilderberg conference, which was organized in Britain, was at Turnberry in Scotland, the one I mentioned earlier where Tony Blair was, where he wasn't on the official list. And that was organized by a guy called Andrew Palmer. Now, Andrew Palmer just so happens to be the personal assistant to the Duke of Kent, who is the Grand Master of World Freemasonry. So you can see there's some pretty clear connections there. Incidentally, we've heard in the news here recently that the Duke of Kent is on the payroll of Boris Berezovsky, which has come out in one of the trials. This is the media giant, the Mercedes-Benz Russian oligarch who made his money through Mercedes-Benz and the media. He had the franchise for the Mercedes right across Russia. And he is actually paying a retainer to the Duke of Kent. He's the cousin to the Queen. So there definitely are occult connections through the Nazis and also through Freemasonry. And anyway, you know, the whole thing is supposed to be secret, which is what the word occult means. And then we don't really know anything about what happened supposedly in this meeting over the weekend of the most powerful people in the Western world, which is pretty shocking.
Tony, I appreciate you spending some time with us here today. My guest, Tony Gosling, the website is very simple, Bilderberg.org, Bilderberg.org. Tony, thank you. Appreciate you coming by True News this afternoon.
I'd just like to plug my radio program.
Oh, yes, go ahead.
I do a drive time show which goes out in Bristol, which is, by the way, the city that sent off the first mission that apparently discovered America. That is John Cabot, financed by Merrick, and this is where apparently America gets its name from, but Bristol was quite an important port, the second city of England for many, many years up till towards the end of the 1800s. And that's the website for that, where you can hear a lot of my investigative reports. I'm sure all of your listeners will find something in there to intrigue them. That's thisweek.org.uk. That's thisweek.org.uk. We'll take you straight to last week's show, where there's a whole report on the Bilderbergers, and also the links to this whole Nazi flight capital network, which was set up in 1944 by Martin Bormann.
And you do a weekly program?
I do a weekly show, yeah. We have an MP or a local politician on in the first hour, and we discuss some of the local news with them. But in the second hour, we go out there and do some real old-fashioned investigative journalism, which I'm afraid is rather sadly lacking in most of the mainstream press in Britain and America.
Yes, it is. Well, we have a lot of True News listeners in the UK, so I know they're going to want to tune into this program. So it's thisweek.org.uk. Tony Gosling, thank you. Appreciate you being on True News.
Thanks, Rick. God bless.
Reporting the countdown to the second coming of Jesus Christ, you're listening to True News, the End Time Newscast.